Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Stanley Fish. He is professor of law at Florida International University and visiting professor of law at Cardozo Law School. He has authored over 200 scholarly publications and books, and his books include the ones that we're going to focus the most on today. There's no such thing as free speech, and it's a good thing too. And the first, how to think about hate speech, campus speech, religious speech, fake news, post-truth, and Donald Trump. So, Dr. Fish, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to everyone.
Well, thank you for asking me.
Okay, great. So, could you please tell us first a little bit about your academic background and what got you interested in questions surrounding free speech?
Well, actually, my academic background is not in law. It is in English literature. And I received my degree in English literature from Yale University in 1962. And spent years teaching first at the University of California at Berkeley, then at Johns Hopkins, and then at Duke University, the University of Illinois at Chicago, and finally the two positions that you mentioned at the beginning of your introduction. In the middle of the 1970s, I began to be interested in legal questions. And I taught and co-taught some courses in law in an adjunct way. But then when my wife and I moved to Duke University in 1985, I was offered a position both in the liberal arts school and at the law school. So then I became half-time law professor and half-time professor of English. And later, after I was at the University of Illinois at Chicago, I became entirely a professor of law and do not any longer teach in the liberal arts school. The link between literary studies and legal studies was the question of interpretation and evidence and the nature of texts. So
Right.
those questions, of course, are shared by the two disciplines, and that was how I became interested in the law.
And specifically about free speech, what got you interested in that?
Well, I guess back in the early 90s, it would have been, or perhaps in the late 80s, early 90s, I had some occasion to teach a few cases in the jurisprudence of freedom of speech. And I was struck at the time by how odd that jurisprudence seemed to me, and how that there was a gap, a distance between the rhetoric of free speech, with its celebration of classical liberal values, and the way in which free speech jurisprudence actually worked. And so then I wrote my first essay, which on the subject, which was called "There's No Such Thing as Free Speech, and It's a Good Thing Too." And then I continue to be interested in the matter, writing a number of essays through the years. And finally, last year in 2019, the full-length book, The First.
So, how would you define free speech? And is the definition important here to understand your position on free speech?
Yes, it is, because my position is that one cannot define free speech because it is not a single fixed thing that will sit still while you pay attention to it. Instead, free speech varies. The features of what we call free speech vary with the situations in which it's invoked. So that there's no one free speech doctrine which then is applied to many situations. Instead, there are many situations in the context of which something called free speech takes a certain shape, but it's a shape specific to that context, rather than some abstract entity called free speech to which we're supposed to be faithful.
Is free speech always a political matter?
Yes, it is, because since there's no such thing as free speech as an abstract value, any form that free speech takes, as I said a moment ago, it will take in the context of some situation, and all human situations are involved politically in some way or another, in the sense that there are always more than one way to look at a situation and to evaluate it. Now, in the context of free speech questions, what this means is that the definition of what is included in free speech will, as I said earlier, depend on the particular historical situation in which it's invoked. And since that situation will always, in some strong sense, be a political one, free speech will always be a political value.
So in your work, you distinguish between free speech in principle versus free speech in practice. Could you tell us about
well,
that?
Well, I wouldn't say that so much as I would say there's no such thing as free speech in principle. And what you have are the many practices in which someone invokes the concept of free speech. Now, everyone, a lot of people who work in this area, other scholars, believe that there's a free speech principle, and they're always in search of it. But my argument, and it's not only mine, several other people have made it, is that the search for a free speech principle will always fail.
Would you say that free speech always commits people to censorship in any way?
Yes, I would say that. I would say that, I guess, in two different ways. First of all, whenever you say something, you're picking out features in the world and declaring them to be the important features, which means that you have implicitly either downgraded or indeed denied other features that might have been picked out. So that in that sense, the very act of speech is a speech is an act that limits what can be said and seen. And so in that sense, free speech is an act of censorship. But in another sense, we might, or an extension or complication of what I've just said, you might rather formulate it this way. Freedom of speech is what in a particular situation is allowed to be said, but in no situation is everything allowed to be said. So that whenever you have a working idea or doctrine of free speech, it is operating within a zone. And in that zone, certain things have already been named as things you cannot or should not say, and other things have been identified as things you should say. So in that sense, the act of censorship is necessary for free speech to function. If free speech were the absolute principle that some people take it to be, then anything and everything could be said. But then there would be no mechanism for determining which of the things that are said are important and relevant and which are to be discarded or ignored. But of course, in all situations, that decision has already been made, either consciously or implicitly by the culture. So censorship and free speech, rather than being opposed, are inextricably tied to one another.
Free speech advocates very frequently invoke the work by John Stuart Mill. What do you think about Mill's position on free speech?
Well, I think Mill's On Liberty is, especially chapter two of that book, is the place to go for a classic definition of free speech, at least as it has been celebrated in England and America, where Mill's options are still echoed and indeed cited. And Mill's idea of free speech is based on the notion that nothing is ever absolutely settled, and that anyone who tells you that some question has been settled is in fact trying to impose a challengeable point of view as if it were the only possible point of view. Therefore, Mill says, we must be continually alert to the things that have been shut out or occluded or ignored or dismissed or marginalized in the world of speech. And we must do our best always to bring them to our consciousness and to full attention. And he goes so far as to say at a certain point, and this is often quoted, that if everyone in the world did believe one thing to be true, it would be up to us to invent challenges to that accepted one true thing. In other words, you can't allow a situation to exist, says Mill, in which a truth is thought to be permanently settled. So his doctrine is a doctrine of permanently unsettling what are taken to be conventional truths. And that view of the matter sits very well with classical liberal doctrine as it's come down to us, let's say, from John Locke to John Rawls, with lots of stops and detours in between. Because also in classical liberal doctrine, authority is no longer located in an antecedent identity, let's say, of a god or an emperor or of the brute empirical world. Rather, authority is something that must be determined by individuals in the course of always probing the current statements of the way things are. And that's a central liberal tenet, that we do not rest in truths that have been given to us by antecedent authorities. Instead, we continually seek to the truth, and in doing so, we must necessarily challenge received wisdom. So, since that is, I think, a basic principle of liberal thought, it is also the basic principle of free speech theory as Mill delivers it. And so, at least on that level, free speech theory and liberal thought are very much the same thing.
So nowadays there are many politically engaged people that care about issues regarding free speech. Is that a recent phenomenon historically?
Well, in the United States, and probably also in England, and I'm not myself knowledgeable enough in other areas to pronounce, free speech issues only became prominent at the beginning of the 20th century, and especially around World War I in the United States, where there were attempts by the government to punish or sanction speech that was considered to be unpatriotic. And at that moment, two Supreme Court justices, Oliver Wendell Holmes and Justice Brandeis, stepped in and began to insist on a way of thinking about free speech that made it a much more prominent issue than it had been before.
So would you say then that from an historical perspective, it's a very recent political phenomenon?
Well, yes, at least as one that carries the resonance that freedom of speech now carries, not only in the United States and England, but all over the world. And there are any number of international covenants, European and other covenants, which put a high premium on freedom of speech and on freedom of religion. So I think that the prominence of free speech issues and also of religious exercise issues has increased in the last half century and probably will continue to be very prominent.
Would you say that there are any particular contexts or instances where free speech is really a thing or not?
No, not if we mean by a thing something that you can point to as a fixed and standing value. I think you can say, however, that in certain areas of practice, questions which wear the label free speech are extremely prominent. For example, the academy, colleges and universities. That is one of those areas where free speech issues seem always to be in the news, although it is my view that this is a category mistake. And that there are in fact very few free speech issues on campuses.
And do you think that free speech would be in any way important, as some people say, to try to get at the truth, to try to understand what the truth is about?
Well, that's one of the classic answers to the question, what is free speech for? What good is it? What does it do for us?
Right.
There are a number of answers to that question. One of them is the one that you just gave. Free speech allows us requires us to search for the truth in a way that is not impeded by censorship. Other values attached to free speech are the fashioning of a informed citizens who can then make responsible decisions in a democratic context. Another one is that free speech is what prevents a majority in a democratic society from silencing the voices of a minority. So those are all answers to the question, what is free speech for? Why do we have it? Why do we value it? But one of my arguments is that merely by asking that question, what is free speech for, you have logically committed yourself to censorship. Now, when I say that, people always raise their eyebrows or roll their eyes because it sounds so odd. But if you think about it for a minute, if you have an answer to the question, what is free speech for? For example, you think it facilitates the search for truth, then you're going to have to, then you will realize at some point that some forms of speech don't facilitate the search for truth. In fact, in a variety of ways, they obstruct the search for truth. And then you have to make the decision, perhaps, to sanction or censor those forms of speech. Not in violation of the doctrine of free speech, but in order to realize it. So that if you really do believe that the business of speech is to facilitate the search for truth, then you have an obligation to identify and then to silence forms of speech that will frustrate that search. So this goes back to an earlier point that in our conversation, the relationship between free speech and censorship.
In the particular context of academia, do you think that students should have a right to freedom of expression?
No. In general, I don't think students have any rights at all. That is, except one, and it's an important one, and that's the right to competent instruction. And I would define or include in competent instruction not only the requisite degrees and knowledge and experience as evidenced in publications, but I would also include the insistence by the instructor that the material be taught in a way that is not political, that is not slanted by some agenda that the professor has. So students, I believe, have the right to be taught A, by persons who are well trained in the subject matter, and B, by teachers who teach the material and do not attempt to smuggle into the material their ideologies. Otherwise, students do not have any rights of freedom of speech. If you're in a classroom and you raise your hand and the instructor calls on you and you ask a question or bring up an issue, your instructor is perfectly in his or her rights to say, well, that might be an interesting point to discuss, but not in this class. We're not going in that direction. That's not one of the concerns that we're going to explore in this course. So does the student then have a right to jump up and down and say, but I have free speech, I have free speech? The answer is no. Yes, you do have free speech, in some limited sense, and you can exit from the classroom and then exercise it. But while you're in the classroom, the kind of speech that you can utter, the kind of speech that will then initiate a conversation or a discussion, is limited by the instructor's concerns.
And what if we are talking about questions that are highly disputed and, for example, different researchers, scholars, professors have differing opinions on those questions? Do you think that in the context of the classroom, students should be able to dispute the specific professor's position?
Well, it depends. I mean, there are some contexts in which a professor wants to encourage the introduction of points of view that so far in the discussion haven't been heard. And it's a perfectly reasonable pedagogical strategy to do that. But I am saying that it is not a pedagogical requirement.
Okay.
If it were made a pedagogical requirement, you would be elevating a certain view of free speech over the educational goals that you're attempting to pursue. The way I put this in the book is that academics are not in the free speech business. Academics are not in the free speech business. They are in the education business. And again, as I said a moment ago, there may be occasions in which an instructor wants to open up a discussion, and that is his or her pedagogical choice. But if the instructor doesn't want to open up the discussion, but wants to keep the discussion on the steady path that he or she has introduced, that too is his right. And that's one of the things I mean when I say that there are very few real free speech issues in the in universities and campuses. Now, of course, we can turn the tables and put the spotlight on the instructor and ask the same question that you asked about students. What kind of free speech rights do instructors have? And the answer turns out to be just about the same, very little. That is, the instructor must teach courses as they are listed or described in the catalog. And often in the course, in the context of a course that has many sessions, that it's a very large course and there are a number of instructors, each of whom has a class of about 20 to 35 students. The curriculum is set. That is, the department has set the curriculum, which texts are going to be read. Although there may be a little bit of play in the joints in that situation, in general, those rules must be adhered to, in part because there's often an exam given which covers all of the sections. Therefore, you must be, all sections must be teaching the same material. Now, suppose an instructor says, well, I don't like the choices that have been made by the department. I think the department should have chosen another set of texts. And I don't like survey courses in general. What then? My answer to that instructor would be, get into another line of work. because you're not playing the game and obeying its rules as they are set. So that at every point in a constrained context, like the context of higher education, there are always limitations on what can be freely said. And we shouldn't, at least I argue, regard classroom situations as if they were equivalent to Hyde Park Corner or open street discussions where someone gets on a soapbox or climbs on a chair and just declaims on everything and anything. That's not what goes on in education. So another area in which free speech issues often invoked by instructors as well as by students just don't really have any play.
Does it make sense to distinguish between speech and action?
No. And that I'll say no, and then I'll say, but it is necessary to do so. Now that's not, it might sound like a paradox, but I don't think it is. A lot of what goes on in free speech doctrine depends on a distinction between speech and action. And it's a distinction which is clarified again by John Stuart Mill at the beginning, I think, of the third chapter of On Liberty, where he talks about two situations. So suppose you have a general sentiment against corn dealers. That's his example. I'm not quite sure myself what corn dealers are. And he says, and that you walk around the village square or the town square with signs indicating your disapproval of what corn dealers are doing and the suggestions of laws that should be passed against them and of criminal sanctions that they should in fact suffer. That's okay, says Mill. That's freedom of speech. But suppose the same crowd with the same signs then surrounds the house in which a corn dealer lives and begins calling out in menacing terms and naming a particular corn dealer. Then, says Mill, what was before speech has now turned into the action of making a credible threat. He doesn't use that phrase, credible threat, but that's the phrase that would now be used in free speech jurisprudence. So at that moment, when your abstract denunciation of corn dealers has turned into a targeted invective against a particular corn dealer sitting in his house eating dinner with his family, then at that moment, speech has turned into action, and actions are always regulatable, the object of regulation by the government. So that's an important distinction as Mill makes it, and I think one that is still in force in a variety of forms in many countries. But in a more general way, speech and action cannot be distinguished because each of them has effects on the world, effects which alter the world and which have an impact on persons. For example, if you call people names, denigrate them, denigrate their ancestry or their ethnic identity or their racial identity, have you just engaged in a form of speech, or have you instead caused, often intentionally, an injury? And a lot of people would say, yes, you have intentionally caused an injury. So that the old proverb that we all learned, at least that I learned when I was a young boy, sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me, turns out, as everyone really knows, to be false. So that in that way we can talk about speech and action, speech being just one form of action rather than speech over here, weightless and abstract, largely occurring in the head, and action over here occurring in the world. Both what we call speech and what we call action occur in the world and have effects. But as I said a moment ago, even though I believe that to be the case, that the distinction between speech and action will not hold up under investigation, nevertheless, it must be assumed to be true in order for free speech to do the kind of work in society that we want it to do. It becomes the distinction between free speech, between speech rather, and action, becomes one of those distinctions that you can invoke in what I call the rhetoric of free speech action. So that the speech action distinction is something that can be invoked independently of its ultimate philosophical validity. The marketplace of ideas is another phrase that can be invoked independently of the fact that no one has ever seen it, no one will ever be able to find it. It is, in fact, doesn't exist, etc., etc. But one must always make a distinction between what is ultimately true, and what works politically and socially in a society. I hope that makes sense
Yeah,
to you.
it makes sense perfectly. Okay, so talking now ab about another distinction, should we make a distinction between freedom of speech and freedom of inquiry?
Oh, yes, that's an absolutely important distinction for the academy. Remember, a moment ago I said that free spe I'm sorry, that academics is are not in the free speech business. What business are they in? They are in the free inquiry business. Well, what's the difference? The difference is as follows. Free speech is a political value, and we're putting aside for the moment the fact as to whether there is any such thing. But let's say that free speech is a political value. In democratic societies, at least, the name free speech is attached to the idea that all voices in a society should be heard or should have the opportunity to be heard, and none should be silenced, and none should be elevated to a position of prominence in advance. So there's a kind of egalitarian aspect to free speech as a political value. But there is nothing egalitarian about the university, about colleges and universities, where the silencing of speech is the business of almost everyone who is engaged in the project. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm talking about hiring committees, where someone will be hired to fill a position, and 200 people will not be hired to fill that position, and their voice will not be heard in the classroom. Or if someone has been hired, at a certain point, he or she will be considered for promotion and for retainment. And in more cases than not, promotion will be denied and retainment will be denied. So a voice will be silenced. If you submit as an academic your work to a learned journal or to a university press, the odds are that you're likely to be rejected. The number of manuscripts offered is greatly larger than the spaces available. And so again, silencing some voices, sending some voices away and saying, sorry, you won't be heard, we won't give you a platform, and other voices. Now, not only is this the business of the academy, it is the necessary business, because if the object of inquiry is to determine the truth about a matter in the physical sciences, the social sciences, the humanities, if the object of inquiry is to determine the truth of a matter, then what you want are people working in that inquiry whose stature and skills have been validated. And in order to achieve that goal of having a highly skilled community of inquirers, you must, of course, sift out those who are not so highly skilled. So freedom of inquiry demands just the kind of sending away and silencing and non-authorizing of voices that freedom of speech as a political value stand against.
I understand. What about the press and the media more generally? Do you think that free speech applies there?
Well, at least in the United States and in some European countries also, the freedom of the press is often an article of political doctrine. The freedom of press in the United States Constitution, the First Amendment has many working parts. In fact, the first part of it is the religion clause, which ensures the free exercise of religion and argues against the establishment of any kind of state religion. Then there's the free expression clause. Then there's the free association clause, the petition and the freedom to petition and assemble, and then there's the freedom of press clause. So these are all part of the First Amendment in the United States. Now, the freedom of the press is again formulated on the same basis that free speech in general is formulated in a democratic society. That is, it's assumed that those who are in political power will wish to remain in political power and will act in ways to ensure that they do remain. Therefore, there has to be some body of persons devoted to exposing the strategies and, in some cases, machinations of those who are desperately trying to remain in power and are doing things that that they perhaps would not want to come to light. It is the press's job, this of course is classical doctrine, it is the press's job to bring that to light. So a free press, therefore, is an antidote to the kind of tyranny and fixed and settled rule, both political and intellectual, that liberalism stands against. Now, that seems to me to be cogent and coherent view of the press. But then, of course, there's the possibility, not really often acknowledged by members of the press, that the press can itself be engaged in activities that are malevolent. Rather than beneficial, or in a large sense, patriotic. Having a piece of the press, whether in the traditional sense of newspapers and journals, or in the new sense of the various kinds of media that have now become available with the advent of the internet, having a piece of the press is to have a great deal of power, and just as the press at its best works to expose the power of those now in control, so can the press itself exert a power which perhaps needs someone to expose it, although exactly who or what that someone is not clear. So if you own a newspaper, or now if you own some kind of large search engine, you have enormous capability of influencing people, of tainting the discussion, of being the vehicle of lies and exaggerations. And when that happens, the press has become as corrupt as the corrupt officials that it claims to expose.
So I have one final question here that doesn't have to do with free speech. I've heard you saying somewhere that philosophy doesn't matter. Could you
Oh,
explain
yes.
that?
Yes, I will. To put it as briefly as possible, philosophy is the name of an academic discipline. It's a way of thinking about matters which will seem odd to persons who are not philosophers. Most of the people in the world are not philosophers. Philosophers, on the other hand, believe that all people in the world are bad philosophers, that they're always doing, everyone is always doing philosophy, but not doing it well because they have not been trained. Therefore, philosophers believe that in order to responsibly face any problem or crisis, one must first rather consult the best philosophers. And I'm saying that that's absurd. That in fact, the solution to most problems or crises will be found in the history of practice. That is, in whatever field that you are working, there's a practice that is full-fledged and has a long tradition, and it also provides resources for first identifying and then solving problems. A philosopher who can tell you why we are not all brains in a vat, or a philosopher who can discourse for days on the relationship between quiddity and essence, etc., is going to be of no help whatsoever. So my thesis is that the answers to philosophical questions are valuable and have merit in the context of the tradition of philosophical conversation. They don't travel. And if you try to import answers to philosophical questions into real world situations, you're going to have a mismatch. And you're going to have people who are attempting to solve some problem by imposing on it a formulation which came from a fairly minor and isolated academic tradition. Philosophers hate that argument. They absolutely hate it because it is their assumption that they're in the business of thinking clearly and that 99.9999% of the world who are not philosophers don't think clearly. This is where, in the old tradition, we got the idea of the philosopher king. And every philosopher believes that he or she should be king.
Okay, so let's end on that note, Dr. Fish. Thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your questions.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been doing this channel for 3 years, bringing you top academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. And I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Even $1 would already be a great help. Otherwise, you also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. And please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button if you liked the interview. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Per Helge Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunde, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnold Wolf, Tim Hollisey, Henry Kalanias, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernard Hugney, Alexander Dunbauer, Omri Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Yevhen Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Librant, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Staten T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacil Adeza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adaner Usmani, my producers Izar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Giddy, Sardas France, and Niruban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.